where we came from, where we've been. They're eternal questions that say a lot about where we're going as the human race. Welcome to Ancient Mysteries on the Air. Welcome to Ancient Mysteries on the Air. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. And today we're going to talk about something. It's kind of in plain sight, I guess, in some ways, but maybe misinterpreted by some people, but they're there to see. And we're talking about spirits in stone, the secrets of megalithic America, decoding the ancient cultural stone landscapes of the Northeast. And our guest is the author of said book, Glenn Kreisberg. He is a radio frequency engineer, writer, researcher, licensed outdoor guide, and former editor of the Author of the Month page at GrahamHancock.com. He serves as a director at large for the New England Antiquities Research Association, the editor of Lost Knowledge of the Ancients and Mysteries of the Ancient Past. He is the co-founder of the Overlook Mountain Center in Woodstock, New York. Glenn, thank you for joining us today. A pleasure to talk about spirits in stone.
Thanks very much for having me, Jim. Happy to be here.
So let me ask you, when we're talking about these megaliths in America, first of all, who knows, maybe there's somebody out there who's not heard of the concept of a megalith. Maybe you can explain what it is and how many of them are there?
Well, a megalith is generally considered a very large stone. When we think about the megalithic cultures of Europe, northeastern Europe, we think of Stonehenge. When we think of megalithic cultures from the Mediterranean, we think of the Egyptians, we think of the Malta temple culture. They all utilized large stones in their construction thousands of years ago. So the question is, do we have this type of practice taking place in America, and specifically in Northeast America, where ancient populations are not given credit with having done so? So there was a census done in 1880, a U.S. census, and it did a survey of what they called stone fence, agricultural survey, and it found over 240,000 miles of stone walls in New England. So that's a lot. That's enough to reach to the moon or to wrap around the earth 10 times. That's a lot of stone walls. So that would have all had to have been built in a period of time of basically just around 200 years, if you're talking about a survey that was done in 1880. So there wasn't really the population here of settlers, of colonists, of Europeans who came to have built all that stonework in that amount of time. So a lot of it must have been pre-existing to when the Europeans arrived. And the type of stonework we're talking about is not what you might typically consider megalithic, because the stones aren't typically as big as what we see in Europe and in other parts of the world, although there are some large megalithic stones, as you see on the cover of the book. That's a site in Massachusetts that called Burnt Hills that has some quite large stood-up stones. Several meters tall. And we do find other examples of those. But a lot of times what we're talking about are Karen fields, great Karens. These are piles of stones purposefully constructed and in a very orderly manner by somebody with some idea in mind. So a lot of times Karens are marking a trail, or they're marking the site of a significant event. In some cases, there might be burials. In some cases, it could be part of a symbolic representation. So those are the Karens. And then we also have these large boulders that are stood up, again, like dolmen that you would see in northwestern Europe, a very large stone placed on some base stones, usually three. And what we find in Northeast America is that these are many times oriented to the cardinal directions. Their noses or faces are oriented north, south, east, or west. And we also find that they're in alignment with one another to mark the solstices and the equinoxes. So these are the, these are basically what we're talking about. Many times we'll see a combination of the large boulders, the walls, the cairns that form effigies, either serpents or turtles or things of that nature. So we can discuss that as well.
Yes, let's do talk about effigies because, for example, I'm from Ohio. Now, people, actually a very small percentage of our audience listens from Ohio, but I'm from Ohio and had a little bit of experience with the Serpent Mount, which I believe is an effigy mound, and is in the shape of a snake. How common are these effigies across North America?
They are quite common, and I don't think we should be that surprised to find turtle effigies. Serpent effigies, particularly the turtle effigy, because it is so common among Native American spirituality and very much part of their creation myth. I think universally, turtle cairns, or turtle symbols, I should say, and the turtle itself are very much part of the Native spirituality and mythology involving their creation myth. And you know, again, I think that's very universal. When it comes to snakes and serpents, this is another kind of universal cult or belief system very early. And that ties into a lot of other types of very ancient pre-Christian mythology.
When you have a very large kind of site like a serpent mount, is there some thought that there was the creation of this so someone else could see it, like the gods or the spirits? Was there a worship aspect to this?
I think there very well could have been. I think the significance of the serpent is very complicated. You have, of course, there are some people who think the Serpent Mound in Ohio is a representation of the constellation Draco. And there is a large portion of the Serpent Mound that does conform with the shape of the constellation Draco. And I found this out when researching the site in Lewis Hollow that's written about in the book, that also has a petriform, a stone construction that seems to mirror the constellation Draco. So I think many ancient cultures were aware of this constellation, whether it was the Greek or the Chinese or the Persians. Even the Norse and the Celts were aware of Draco and considered it a snake or a serpent effigy. And the importance of Draco, which I researched, has to do with it being a circumpolar constellation, meaning it's always spinning around celestial north, which is the spot in the sky where our Earth's axis points to. And due to what's known as precession of the equinox, that point is not a fixed point, but it inscribes a giant circle in the sky. And for that circle to make its full cycle takes about 25,000-26,000 years, which is the cycle of precession. And a lot of mythology talks about precession being responsible for the rise and fall of civilization, consciousness, technology. In many ancient cultures, this was a strongly held belief. If you research the Vedic scriptures, East Indian, they had a very strong belief in these cycles, the yugas, tied to what the Chinese called the great year, or this 26,000 year cycle. And it was a cycle of a rising and a falling, 12,000 years of ascending towards a golden age, and then 12,000 years of descending into a dark age. And in that cycle, and to me, it's kind of obvious where we are. We're coming out of the darkest of ages and just beginning an ascension of, you know, 10,000 or more years to the high point in our human state of consciousness.
So in essence, these ancient ancestors, they were far more sophisticated and enlightened than we give them credit for.
Well, a lot of people believe so, and a lot of evidence points to that. It sure seems like they were able to do things and understand things and had a connection to the natural world that was far greater, far more intimate, far more profound than any kind of relationship we have today. And this may not just have been a physical relationship, but it could have also been a mental or a spiritual relationship. And it may very well have been, I think at the other end of this cycle, the way our minds and brains behave would probably be very much considered an altered state of consciousness from our state of being now at this point in the cycle. So in that higher state of consciousness, yes, I think we had greater abilities, perhaps including psychic abilities we don't have today.
Are there any engineering feats to these various sites that would indicate that they had some secret technology or power to move things psychically or anything like that? Are there any hints towards that? In other words, are there things there and engineering techniques and things that they, quote, shouldn't have known or been able to accomplish?
Well, I'm not going to speak so much to engineering, but what I would point to, and there's a chapter in the book about this, is the work of David Johnson, who's a dowser. And what Johnson's work has shown, and he's worked in South America with the Nazca, he's worked in the Southwest with the Hopi and the ancestral Anasazi and the Blackfoot and many different tribes. And what he's done is he's also worked here in the Northeast in the Catskills and in many sites dowsing. And he uses the same methodology. And what he's showing is that many of the stone constructions are built on above aquifers, or what he calls areas of higher permeability in the bedrock, where fissures and cracks exist that allow the groundwater to flow more easily through the bedrock. So, if the ancient populations, if the natives were building these sites based on where these aquifers were and marking them, how did they know they were there? Well, they must have done it through some type of divination, the way Johnson does is with a dowsing rod. So they had that ability, which to me is very, dowsing is one of those things. I'm an engineer, and I can't claim I understand exactly how it works, but it does apparently work and hold up to some reliability when it comes to methodology. At least David Johnson's work does. And I do think it has something to do with being able to be sensitive to changes in the local electromagnetic field of the Earth. Another example of this, which probably also helps answer your question, these chambers in Putnam and Dutchess County, we have these wonderful megalithic chambers. They're quite large and beautifully constructed, and they are very much in the tradition of what you would find in Northwest megalithic Europe. They're like an eye chamber in the sense that they resemble an eye. And the researcher John Burke, who some of your listeners might be familiar with, who's done a lot of research on electromagnetism, he discovered that many of these chambers have entrances that have electromagnetic hotspots or spikes in the Earth's local electromagnetic field. So how they knew where that was to construct these chambers with their entrances, basically aligned with where these EM hotspots are, is a mystery. The chambers also, many of the entrances happen to be aligned with winter solstice sunrises. I don't go too terribly into the chambers because a lot of people have written about them, but they do play a big part in the mystery of the megaliths in the Northeast, and they are quite fascinating.
One thing that interests me is this idea of commonalities between the sites in geographically disparate areas. And to me, it seems like there's two possibilities. One, these groups somehow were communicating with each other over decades, over years, hundreds of years, and they were sharing techniques, symbolism, that type of thing. Or all of these groups were tying into some universal source for this information. What are your thoughts on that, or am I missing something?
No, those are the kind of the two prevalent theories: diffusionism versus isolationism. And do these things develop in isolation from one another, or were they developed in one place and then diffused or spread around? And actually, I guess what you'd be missing is that they're not mutually exclusive. It could be both. It could be that some things are developed in isolation, even though they're the same as something on the other side of the world. Take the blowgun, for instance. I think it was developed in you know, evidence shows it's from Africa, but evidence also shows it's from South America. Doesn't mean that the two cultures that used the blowgun came in contact with each other. Just means that they were both ingenious and you know, came up with the same good idea of how to create a weapon. But at the same time, you have concepts like pyramid building that do seem to have spread and not necessarily have happened all at once in different places, but began in the Middle East, and then over time spread through a cultural diffusion, suggesting that there was, you know, early transoceanic voyages where cultures did take their ideas and spread them around the globe. And I think there's some pretty good evidence to that. You have, there was a wonderful researcher, she's no longer with us, Betty Medgars, who was a NERA member. You mentioned NERA in my intro. And she was an archaeologist who worked in South America and showed how pottery came to South America from Japan. And of course, this wasn't accepted very well by her colleagues, but she stuck with it her entire life. And she worked at the Smithsonian and published and died at her desk at 92 years old, the longest continual employee of the Smithsonian Institution, because she was hired by them when she was 17. But she was amazing and definitely a big proponent of diffusion, that big ideas can travel far given time and human will.
Now, in terms of the powers that be in archaeology and so forth, and kind of the quote mainstream thinking, these ideas about these megaliths and maybe indicating a far more advanced society. I'm assuming you've seen some pushback on that thought. Is that correct?
Well, in the Northeast, it's generally not considered that the Native population before contact with the Europeans, that the Native Americans did anything with stone. So if you were to talk to the archaeologists at, say, Marist or Vassar College, Marilyn Johnson, or the archaeologist at Bard College, Christopher Linder, or the Sunni archaeologist here in New Paltz in the Mid-Hudson Valley, Joe Diamond, they would all say, no, the natives didn't do this. But they'd be wrong, because there are other professionals in our region who've kind of made the breakthrough and had the aha moment. There was an important conference at Colgate University at the end of 2014, hosted by Anthony Avini. And Tony Avini is probably the premier archaeoastronomer of the Americas, of the United States. And he held a symposium called the Stars and Stone Symposium. Or maybe it was the Stones and Stars. You can look it up through Colgate. And he was presenting evidence from an archaeologist, Lori Rush, up at Fort Drum in the Adirondacks, who found a calendar site, an effigy site, a site that had alignments with the solstices and equinoxes, and it was threatened by development on the base on Fort Drum. And, you know, she was the cultural resource manager. She documented it and protected the site. And it was so important that Avini suggested they have a symposium to address it. And he invited academics, archaeologists. He invited regulators from the Department of Fish and Wildlife and from the New York State Parks and Recreation, Historic Preservation from the Department of Interior, and he invited tribal preservation officers from a bunch of tribes in the Northeast and even up in Canada. And they all came together at Colgate and discussed these stone sites and their connection and their importance with celestial, or what we would call observational astronomy, which is what the Native Americans practiced. And up in Colgate, they have a wonderful planetarium visualization center where you can actually put up on the ceiling any day and date and what the sky would look like. And the tribal folks, the preservation officers and the tribal elders shared stories that described events in the sky and positions of stars. And they were able to recreate these at the planetarium there. So it was really fascinating. And it was a watershed moment because for the first time you had these three groups of people, the preservationists from the Native Americans, the academics, and the regulators, acknowledging. And many times the regulators had acknowledged that they hadn't had any sites like this on their radar. But of course, now they realize that there were sites like this in our region, and they can't really be ignored.
I have to believe many of these sites have been lost. I could picture somebody in even the 1900s easily saying, and when I say 19, the 20th century usually saying, oh, there's a pile of rocks, let's go knock it down. I mean, people just out of sheer ignorance. Is there any estimate of how many of these sites have been lost? Is there any concept of that?
You know, that would be really hard to say. All I can do is extrapolate from the number that I see on the landscape today. And there are so many of them that you can't really help but realize that there must have been almost countless numbers that were destroyed, because it was what I call a convenient untruth that there was no civilization here before the Europeans arrived a few hundred years ago. Of course, there had been. There's a wonderful book called Manitou, The Sacred Landscape of New England's Native Civilization by James Maver and Byron Dix. It's kind of the Bible of Nera, I guess you could say. And it really went a long way towards proving that the Native Americans in the Northeast did build in stone and did construct their stonework to align with events on the horizon, with the important events helping them plot the year and planting. And this was not something that that was foreign to them. And what you always hear in the history books is that the ancient population in the Northeast, as you go back in time, was very transient, very, you know, hunter-gatherer. They just move from place to place, using up the resources, and then moving on, and never really having time to develop any kind of sophisticated worldview or belief system. And of course, that's nonsense. In the Hudson Valley and in the region where I'm from, you have places that even the archaeologists have to admit have been continually habitated for over 10,000 years, basically for as long as people have been in this region. These places, like Kingston and a little bit further south, Wappingers. These are places where land travel corridors and water corridors, many creeks, navigable creeks and rivers, come and converge at a single place along a much bigger river, the Hudson River. And, they found lithic production sites, they found burials, they find continual habitation from contact all the way back to paleo times. So there was plenty of time in that period for humans to have developed very sophisticated beliefs, to have conducted observational astronomy, to have really put down roots and developed a civilization. Some of the footprint of that is still existing, even though there may be other footprints on top of it. It's still discernible as you get into the backwoods and you find these sites. And my approach is, I take a GIS methodology where I plot the latitude and the longitudes of all these sites and look for patterns of concentration and distribution of the different features, see how they align with one another. And of course, the biggest pattern that has jumped out has been the solstice, sunrises, and sunsets, and how they're memorialized in the position of these stone sites and their relationship to one another.
Now, the title of the book is Spirits in Stone. And of course, you've got kind of the nuts and bolts of this, you know, how did they do this and so forth. But where does the spiritual come in to Spirits in Stone?
Well, I think that that speaks to what people get out of these sites. And I think I was touching on a little bit earlier when I said that a lot of the ancient cultures probably have a much different sense of being than we do. And it probably would be considered even an altered state of consciousness compared to what we have today. So these sites, if these were, and many of them were, what I believe to be spiritual sites for the natives, ceremonial sites, where they practice their religious practices, carried out those beliefs. And it was very much shamanistic. It was communing with the spirit world, connecting with the spirit world, keeping in harmony and in balance with the spirit world. And in many cases, the spiritual connection between the sites built on in the plane of the living is, again, through Johnson's research, there's the hydrologic features, the water features connected to these sites that represent the underworld. And a lot of times that's represented as the water serpent. And then, of course, the way these play out on the surface, connecting with the stars and the sun, you know, very much speaks to this three-dimensional spiritual view of the world that I think they incorporated in many of their activities. I mean, I think when we see historic markers for Native Americans and we see or Native American important sites and we see artifacts that are associated with them, and they're never really given credit for spiritual activity. It's almost always, this is where they habitated. This is where they prepared their food. This is where they prepared their game. This is how they made their knives and utensils and utility tools. But they never speak to the spirituality. And that's because they didn't do anything that didn't involve spirituality, whether it was making those knives or preparing that food or going on that hunt and taking that game. Everything had spirit. Everything had life force within it. In many times, that belief permeated every part of their existence. So whether these sites were used for spirit quests or places that tribes would gather to carry out their spiritual activities. And again, if that was the case, and that is the case, you wouldn't expect to find the kind of artifacts and debris that you would typically find at a habitation site, where when archaeologists are digging, they're basically digging through trash piles and trying to put together a history of the people that lived there through the trash, kind of reverse engineering. If these are spiritual sacred sites, which many believe they are, you're not going to find that there. You're going to find that the sites were venerated, were protected. In fact, Ezra Stiles, who was the, I believe he was the first chancellor of Yale University, I want to say, he was great friends with the Native Americans and knew about these sites and wrote that whenever they would approach one of these sites when being guided by the Indians through the woods, and these are stone cairn sites, they would give it a wide berth and go a half a mile out of their way just to avoid going through that site. So these sites deserve protection. They deserve respect. I don't reveal their locations in the book. You can't really use this book as a if you know sites, you can certainly compare them to what you see in this book, but this book's not going to lead you to any of these sites. Or I should say there's hundreds of them discussed, and maybe one or two of them, which are on state land right off of hiking trails, you could come upon. But for the most sites, for the most part, when you come across or encounter sites like this, you want to leave no trace. Don't really interact with them as far as touching or taking or leaving anything. They are, you know, they are really to be treated with great respect.
Are you optimistic about A, the preservation of them, and B, maybe a wider and better understanding of them, a more enlightened understanding?
I am. I think we're at a time where views are changing, and where historians and academics are beginning to realize that there is something to this claim that natives built in stone in the Northeast, and that some of those remnants are still there. And public awareness helps stave off development. NERA, the group I belong to, I'm a member of, they're very instrumental in protecting sites, because when people find these things and they're threatened, usually a planning board or a concerned planning board member or a concerned local citizen will contact NERA, get information on these sites, on other sites that have been threatened, and how they've organized and brought experts in to help show that maybe it's something that should be protected and preserved. So there are movements out there. There are resources out there. The tribal preservation officers of the tribes need to be contacted. They are required by federal law. If it's a project that involves any kind of federal money, the tribes have to be consulted. So that's one level of protection there. But a lot of things do slip through the cracks, and there have been uncountable numbers of sites that have been unfortunately destroyed and may never be known.
Well, that's a very sad thing, but it's good to know that things are moving in the right direction. The book is Spirits in Stone, The Secrets of Megalithic America, Decoding the Ancient Cultural Stone Landscapes of the Northeast. Our guest has been Glenn Kreisberg. And also, I should mention, the foreword on this book is by none other than Graham Hancock. That's quite a feather in your cap, Glenn, for sure. And I guess the question is, where can people find the book at this point?
Well, it's certainly available through all the large online retailers. I'm certainly a fan of local small bookstores. My store here in Woodstock, New York, not my store, but the local small bookstore, Golden Notebook, certainly has them for sale online. People could go there and buy them. I think there's a link on a website. So we have a nonprofit called the Overlook Mountain Center, which has protected and stewards the land up on the Lewis Hollow site, which is about 40 acres that includes that Draco Petriform and dozens of cairns and great cairns. So overlookmountain.org, I think, has a link to purchasing the book for a discount, and also to make a donation as part of that sale. So there's a few different ways. Golden Notebook, overlookmountain.org, amazon.com. You can Google it and probably find a dozen other ways to buy it online. So, you know, if you're so inclined, it's out there.
By all means, please do check it out. It is Spirits in Stone. Our guest has been the author, Glenn Kreisberg. Glenn, thank you for joining us today.
Jim, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.